Aviation Quest is C101, wind 270 degrees, 10 knots, runway 27 left, cleared for takeoff.
Aviation Quest CC101, cleared for takeoff, 27 left. V1, rotate. Positive climb.
Aviation Quest CC. Stories from above. The views shared in this podcast are personal and for informational purposes only. They do not reflect any employer or aviation authority, and nothing discussed here should be considered flight training or regulatory guidance. Please always refer to official sources. This episode may also contain product placements. For further information, visit our website aviation-quest.cc.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is episode 29 of our Aviation Quest podcast. My name is Stefan Lorenz. I'm one of the hosts. As always, I'm not alone. I'm very lucky to have my dear friend and proper professional podcaster here by my side. Jürgen, how are you today?
You put some pressure on me, huh? Oh, yeah. By the way, Aviation Quest to See is the name of our podcast, but Stefan was still right. We are both right here. Aviation Quest podcast is our YouTube channel. And before we forget, because it will get enthusiastic here in a minute, what's the video of today? Because you are the FS Clips creator and also, yeah, certainly have a lot of your professional YouTuber, so to say. No, you're a professional pilot, but you are experienced and well-established hobby YouTuber. I say it this way, Stefan, I think this is correct. And your work can also be seen at our Aviation Quest podcast YouTube channel. So what's the flight today?
Yes, so like you said, we always have a flight in the background. Today is a flight that I have done a few times myself. We are flying with Eurowings today. Never done that before on the Airbus A320. And we are flying from Düsseldorf to Bologna in Italy. Very nice flight across the Alps. Very beautiful approach.
Oh, yeah. And if you allow, I got some hopefully very beautiful. Yeah, he deserves it. He deserves it. Adventure and the courage to live it. That's what today's guest represents. Bush pilot, glacier pilot, mission pilot, airline captain, flying for the US Marines and later business jets for global figures from film, sport and politics. More than 30,000 hours in the air. And today, in his 80s, still flying, serving as an airborne deputy for a sheriff's department.
Yes, absolutely. So his name is John Pipkin. And if you never heard of him, then you should listen out because he has an absolutely amazing career behind him. Jürgen has already mentioned some of the highlights, but believe me, there is a lot more. Luckily, he took us through his entire airline career, and not just airline career, aviation career, which was, I was listening to the podcast and he kept pulling stuff out of the head, and then I did this, oh yeah, and then I flew there, oh yeah, and then I remember, and I was like, Jesus, this guy has done everything. So if you want to hear the story of a guy who seems to have covered every single corner of aviation, not just in flying, you know, like FAA and running airlines and all sorts, you are in for a treat. He's a super interesting guy. Really great interview, by the way, Jürgen. Congratulations. I absolutely enjoyed listening to it.
I mean, I was all over the place. After these interviews for days, I think I trashed you with voicemails. It was in February, end of February this year. And I was, don't know, I was full of superlatives. And I think this man, I mean, all the listeners, we are welcoming comments on our YouTube channel. I mentioned Aviation-Quest podcast, or there is also a Discord server. Also to me, professional private on LinkedIn. You will find all the addresses in the teaser. Please comment. I'd be interesting. Is there a superlative for aviation legend, or don't know? There is no title that's, so to say, covering everything John Pipkin is. Would you agree, Stefan. I mean, 30,000 hours alone, it's insane. It's crazy. It's just awesome.
Yeah, and it's not just 30,000 hours, you know, flying.
No,
it's a particular thing. It's from helicopters to airliners to crop dusting to transporting injured people and animals. And I don't know, when I was listening, it was really, I do think...
You know, it's almost whatever you can do in aviation, name it, John did it.
Yes, exactly. And the crazy thing is he's still going. I mean, he's not really retired, yeah. Is he? He loves it so much. So he's still very much involved in aviation. So yeah, like I said, Jürgen, amazing interview. I thought it was super interesting. And yeah, I'm just looking forward to hearing it again.
John, welcome. Yeah, first of all, it's an honor to have you with us, sir. I mean, even though you just said, call me John, but I mean, a lifetime in aviation stands behind you and still the story continues. Where does aviation find you today?
Well, today, aviation-wise, I am still working for the Richland County Sheriff's Department in Columbia, South Carolina. I started working with them part-time in 2010, so I've been associated with them for, 15 years now. I worked full-time for several years, and then I actually retired, went to Alaska and flew in Alaska for a period of time, and then when I came back, they wanted me to go back to work for them full time, and I said, no, I'll go back part time. So that was in 2016, and so I've been with them full time ever since then. And basically, what we do, we had two helicopters and two aircraft. We only have the two aircraft now. We wore out the helicopters, so they're not available. So I was flying helicopters and aircraft for them. One thing about getting older, say I'm working on 82. I'll be 82 in May of this year. And a couple years ago, the insurance company stopped me from flying the helicopters because of my age. And now they're still letting me fly the aircraft, which is the main aircraft, is a Cessna 206. And we have a nice camera system on it. And we do a lot of things for different law enforcement branches. We sometimes work for the U.S. Marshals Federal Task Force. We also work for the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, working with them in association with the Sheriff's Department, basically trying to, catch bad guys. So that's what we do. And we fly at about 3,000 feet, and we have a real good camera on the aircraft. And we can give you just an idea of how good the camera is. But we were on a mission, and we followed a drug dealer at night to an apartment complex, and we're able to see from 3,000 feet and a mile and a half away that he had parked in a handicapped parking spot. So we've got a pretty good camera system. So mainly what we're trying to do is just, you know, help get the criminals. Majority of the stuff we do is with drug-related stuff. So I've been doing that for about 15 years with them, part-time and full-time, and I'm still actively involved in that now.
So you're still supporting the people on the ground with your aviation work, certainly.
Yes, that's what we do. The big advantage is if you start following a car that's involved in a chase where they're trying to run away from the law enforcement, they will, you know, they speed and everything. And so at a certain point, they'll just call off the chase because they don't want to create an accident. But with us being there in the aircraft, they can call off the chase on the ground. We can follow them in the air. And we've had cases where we'd follow someone, they'd call off the chase, we'd follow them, and they'd go to their their house, and they'd be in their house, and then 10 minutes later, the officers on the ground would show up and say, what are you doing with that red Ford in your garage? And they're saying, how do you know we have a red Ford in the garage? Because we saw it, at, you know, with the camera on the airplane.
But, yeah, it's just amazing. But, John, if you allow, let's go back to your very beginning. What first drew you toward aviation? And at what age?
Okay, well, first of all, to go back that far, I've got to give you a little background on where I came from, or my parents and stuff. My father was actually born in 1902 in Dallas, Texas. So he was 44 or 42 years old when I was born in 1944. And we lived on a farm in Greensboro, North Carolina, where it was owned by John McAdoo, who was Register of Deeds of Guilford County. And he had three sons, and Jack, his oldest son, was actually living on the farm at that time. And Jack had a son, Rick, and Rick and I were the same age, and this was when I was about 4 years old. And they had airplanes on the farm. They had a little runway on the farm. They had airplanes on the farm. And my dad had told me that I couldn't go flying in the airplanes because that was dangerous, because he said when he was younger, you know, flying was really dangerous, and which it was, because he came up in the era of Lindbergh and people like that. And so one day Jack had asked me if I would like to go flying, and I can just barely remember some of this because I was maybe between 4 and 5 years old at the time. And I said yes, and so he said that I had to go ask my mother if I could fly. So Rick and I went to the house, and I can remember we didn't really go see my mother. We went and kind of hid in the bushes behind the house, and then we came back, and we told Jack that we could go flying. And it was around Easter time, and so we had our Easter baskets with you know, eggs in the basket. So we took our baskets, and he put us in the back seat, the two of us in the back seat of the Cub, and he put Rick on the outside because that's where the door was on the right side of the aircraft, and me on the inside. And we were small enough that the two of us could fit in the back seat. And so we were flying over the farm. They had Black Angus cattle, and we were trying to bomb the cows with our Easter eggs. And so that kind of is where it all started, when my first airplane ride. And then later on, I had more time with Rick, and his dad was a crop duster. And so I started spending part of my summers there, and Jack would take us flying. And so that's just basically how the aviation bug bit me, and that would have been in 1948. So it's been going on quite a while.
So you mean you started right off with low-level flying that required precision and discipline, certainly?
Yes, I did. And then I can remember just jumping forward many years prior to that. I'm a Christian, and I've had real strong church beliefs when I was growing up. And I remember one time Billy Graham, the evangelist, was talking about people ought to consider going into mission work or becoming a pastor. And so I remember thinking, well, I could be a preacher and a crop duster, because that's what I wanted to do, having been around it when I was growing up. And this was when I was about 16 or 17 years old. And I thought, well, preachers only work one day a week, so I could crop dust during the week and then preach on Sunday. And of course, it didn't work out exactly that way. I did become a crop duster, and I did become a missionary. My first real job in 1968, I went to Liberia for the Methodist Board of Missions, flying a Cessna 180 in Liberia in 68 and 69. So I didn't become a preacher, but I became a crop duster and a missionary. And those were some of the things I did. And then later on, I flew in Haiti for 11 years with Mission Aviation Fellowship. And then I in 2016 ferried an airplane from you know, South Carolina all the way to Alaska, and then trained young missionary pilots how to fly in Alaska. So I've done quite a bit of mission work, but the main thing, I didn't become a preacher, but I did a lot of missionary work, and the crop dusting was one of my enjoyable jobs also.
But Johnny, allow me a missionary flying question. How does flying change when the mission truly matters, you know, beyond the cockpit?
Well, the perfect example of how it works that happened with me, my wife and I were actually in Haiti in 2010 with the major earthquake hit that killed like 300,000 people. And so that year I had retired from NetJets. I had been flying Gulfstreams for NetJets for 9 years, and I'd retired. And of course I worked part-time off and on in Haiti while I was flying for NetJets. And so there was a little town called Hinch, and I was out there one day going to fly back to Port-au-Prince. And it's only about a 30-minute flight, but it takes 5 to 6 hours along real bumpy roads going through the mountains. And they brought a man to the airport. He'd been on a tractor, and the tractor had rolled over and damaged him, had a lot of internal injuries. And so they couldn't take him to the hospital in Port-au-Prince in a car or a truck because the ride would have damaged his internal organs too bad. So we put him in the aircraft, and I flew him down to Port-au-Prince. And about 6 months later, I was back there again, and the man, I was at Port-au-Prince, and the man came walking out of the terminal, and I put him back in the airplane and flew him back to Hinch. So that's just an idea of how the mission work just impacted me and things like that. So when you see that you help, you know, possibly save a person's life and do it. So that's the type of stuff that MAS does. Also, we worked a lot during the hurricanes down there. We deliver supplies and stuff to the different villages. And of course, and then that's some of the type of work that they do.
Yeah, I can imagine this is much more than flying people from A to B. But what happened next in your career?
Well, I have no idea how long the insurance companies are going to allow me to continue to fly, because here, once you turn 70, if you have insurance on your aircraft, which unless you're a commercial operation or doing flight instruction, but as a private individual, you're not required to have insurance on your aircraft. But most people do because of the investment. And then if something happens, they have the liability insurance that will help pay off anything that occurs that way. But after age 70, if you end up trying to change insurance companies or you let your policy lapse, you can't get a policy back. And just for example, I own an Aronca Champ, this is the fourth or fifth airplane I've had. And in the States, we have what they call a sport pilot deal where certain aircraft qualify for this, and you don't have to have a medical. Your driver's license can count as your medical for you to be able to fly that airplane. But you're limited to an airplane that can only have two people. They've just changed it a little bit. You can have a four-place airplane, but you can't have but one yourself and one other person in the airplane. And you can do that with just your driver's license. Well, the insurance company this past year, because I've got that type of airplane, and I've got a medical, and I've got, you know, all the pilot's ratings and everything, so I can fly that type of aircraft. But they said that rather than having, like, if you have a third-class medical here, it's good, you know, for 2 years. We have a form of medical. It's called basic med, and that's good for 4 years, and you don't have to go to an FAA flight surgeon to do that. You can go to your own doctor, and it allows you to fly that type of aircraft, and that's good for 4 years. We also have a requirement that every 2 years you have to have a flight review, and it can be done in any aircraft that you're qualified for, and that qualifies you to fly any other aircraft. So they contacted me last year when I was renewing my policy, and they said, well, you're going to have an FAA medical every year, even though they're good longer than that, and you're going to have a flight review every year in your airplane or a similar type. So a lot of people would get upset by that. And I said, well, can I use the basic med because I'm not doing any real commercial flying, because flying for the sheriff's department is done under what they call public use. And they said, yeah, you can use basic med, but even though it's good for 4 years, you have to do it every year. And the flight review you have to do every year has to be in your airplane or a similar type. Well, a lot of people would have thought that was too restrictive, but the way I looked at it, they could have said, well, you're almost 82 years old. We're just not going to sell you insurance. Yeah. But the way I look at it, if I can't pass a flight review in my own airplane and I can't go to my doctor and have him tell me I'm good enough to fly, I probably shouldn't be flying. So they gave me a way to continue to have the insurance. I try to look at things on the positive side.
I mean, I see you flying hopefully for decades, but let's switch topics a little bit. You were not only, so quote unquote, a very, very versatile pilot. You also played a role in the airline industry as an airline founder. Can you tell us a little bit about this part of your career?
Yeah, the first airline that I actually worked for was Wheeler Airlines. A friend of mine, Warren Wheeler, who was the first black pilot to be hired by a major airline, one of the first, and he got hired by Piedmont Airlines in 1964. Well, Warren and I had learned how to fly together back in the 60s, and I was looking for a job one time, and so I contacted Warren, and he said, yeah, I'll hire you to come in and fly. You know, he was flying Beech 99s at the time, so I went in, and that's like a big King Air, 15-passenger King Air, and so I started flying for Warren, and I flew with him for a while. I left there and did some other jobs, and then I ended up coming back to Warren flying, and I was later on his chief pilot, and then I ended up going to work for an airline called Access Air. Actually, the airline I went to work for was called Chicago Air, and that was in Illinois, and we were flying F-27s. And Wheeler had, before I left him, had gotten F-27s, and so I flew that aircraft for several months or a year, and then Chicago Air had F-27s, so they hired me as their chief pilot on the F-27s, and I helped set that airline up. And then I flew for them, and then I went to work for Midway Airlines out of Chicago, flying DC-9s and MD-80s, and I became an instructor on the DC-9s for them, and then ended up doing some other things, and went to work for Ryan International, who had 727s, and their director of operations had been a pilot at Midway, so he hired me after Midway went bankrupt. He hired me to go to work for that company, Ryan International, and I started out as the director of flight standards, and then I ended up being the director of maintenance for them. And so these were the 727s that used to do the mail deliveries for the Postal Service. And so I did that. And then another airline was starting up called Access Air. And they needed to start this airline up, they were using 737s. And a friend of mine that I'd flown with at Midway Airlines had taken the job as their chief pilot. And at that time, I was working for the FAA as an operations inspector in Colombia. And so he called me and said, John, I'd like for you to come to work for us as our director of training. And so I thought, well, yeah, I can do that. So I didn't really like the job with the FAA, and I'd been there about 3 years. And so I left there and went to work and helped set up Access Air with the 737s. And that's when I got my type rating and everything and ran their training department there. And then they went out of business after about 6 months. So then I went to work for an airline called Capital Cargo on 727s because I was hyped into 727. And so I did that. And there were just several different little airlines that I'd go to work for. There was one called Jet Train that when I was with Ryan, the friend of mine that was with the FAA asked me to come over there, and he introduced me to the people that were starting up Jet Train in Pittsburgh, and they had DC-9s, and so I ended up writing the training manuals and doing the stuff like that and starting that. So I've worked with, you know, setting up several airlines. I think I've worked for 7 different airlines. Unfortunately, most of them went out of business, but that's the way it happens when you have a startup airline. If they're underfunded, they don't usually make it too long. Some of them will make it for a couple of years. Some of them will be out of business within 6 months. So that was my airline career. So I spent off and on 10 to 12 years with different airlines. And I learned that when you're with the airlines, if you're a pilot, if your airline goes out of business or if you go to another airline, you don't get to go in as a captain. You start at the bottom of the seniority list, and so you take a big pay cut. But I had all the requirements for what they call initial cadre. So that's how I ended up being able to start up airlines. That way you keep a little bit better salary because you start out in management, and it's unusual to find people that can go into those positions that are willing to do it. So that was kind of my airline career.
So you mean you were an airline founder, chief pilot, and also in key positions for the FAA. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, the way I ended up with the FAA, I just got tired of the airlines that I was working for going out of business. So I had a friend that had gone to work for the FAA, and so I applied, and then they hired me. And when I got, that's how I ended up in Columbia, South Carolina, because I went to work for the Flight Standards District Office here in Columbia as an operations inspector. And they said I was the most qualified person they ever had because I could do helicopters. I worked for Carson Helicopters for several years, and I flew the S-61, which is like the president's helicopter, and some other stuff for them. And so I could do all the check rides from private through ATP on all the different aircraft and the helicopters. And the only thing, that reason I left the FAA, is I just didn't like being a black hat guy. I wanted to be a white hat guy. So to give you an idea of how people look at the FAA, one of my good friends who's retired from United now, and I see him in the summer because I go to Oshkosh. I've been a judge on antique aircraft at Oshkosh for 30-some years now. And I'd go to see my friend in Illinois, and he found out I went to work for the FAA. He says, John, exactly when did you go to the dark side? So that's how people think about the FAA.
I hope this was a joke. No, I think you did good work there. And overall, I think they are responsible for the safest aviation system in the world, as much as I heard.
Yeah, they are. And the thing is, people, one thing you find, though, is even after I left the FAA, and I was with the FAA when NetJets started their Gulfstream operations. And this is back in like 2001. And they set up their operation in Hilton Head. And so they came to our office. So I was one of the inspectors that they met with, because they're going to be operating large aircraft, the Gulfstreams 4, 5 and stuff like that. And I couldn't go to work directly for them because it was a conflict of interest, because our office regulated them. So the advantage of going to work for Access Air, that put something between me and them. So then I was able to go to work for them. But after I left and I was working for NetJets, even when I'd come to the airport, people were reluctant to say stuff about airplanes. I think they thought I was a spy for the FAA, but they are responsible for safety. Yeah.
John, if you allow me to segue back a few minutes, because what just caught my attention was helicopter and president's helicopter or something like this. Can you give us a little bit an overview about your helicopter career? When did this happen?
Okay, well, just to go back with the helicopter things, I learned how to fly helicopters in Columbia, South Carolina. And I got my commercial rating back then. If you were already a commercial pilot, you could get your commercial rating with just 25 hours in the helicopter, and you didn't have to take a written, you just had to pass a check ride. So I did that. I used my GI Bill to do that. And then for another 25 hours, I could get my helicopter instructor's rating. So I did that. And the thing is, what I always said was funny was I had 50 hours in helicopters, and I was a helicopter instructor, and I couldn't even spell helicopter instructor, but I was one. So that's how I got into helicopters. And then when I was in Myrtle Beach, I was able to fly with a friend of mine down there that gave helicopter rides, so I did some of that. And then I ended up getting hired by Carson Helicopters, and they did long line sling work, and they did gravity survey work, and that's where I flew the S-61. They typed me in that helicopter, and of course I had my airline transport rating. So what was really interesting, when I did the check ride to get my type rating in the S-61, I had taken the ATP written, which gives you instrument capabilities in the helicopter. So I took the type rating in that, and I shot an approach, and so that gave me my ATP in the helicopter and my type rating. And I'd also taken the helicopter instrument instructors written. So I taught the inspector through an ILS approach. So in one check ride, I got my IFR ATP rating in helicopters. I got the type rating in the S-61, and I got my helicopter instrument instructor's rating all in one check ride, and Carson paid for that. So that was worth multiple thousands of dollars to get all that in one check ride.
John, and what you mentioned more than one time in the last minutes was, or before that, was NetJets. What was it for you to fly with business jets? And I think you got into nice company there, huh?
Yes, NetJets, as I say, when they started up, it was originally executive jet, and they were flying, you know, the smaller jets, and then Warren Buffett bought the company. And so he made arrangements through Gulfstream he ordered something like 60 Gulfstream 4s. And when they came to our office to set this up, they only had 3 aircraft. And I saw right there that that's where I'd like to go to work, flying the Gulfstreams. And so when I finally got something between me and them, I applied for a job, and then they hired me. as a pilot, as a co-pilot on the Gulf Streams. And the way the system worked, somebody would buy a quarter share of an aircraft, and then the airplanes, Mr. Buffett bought the airplanes for something like $28 million. And so he was selling the quarter shares at $8 million a share. So he was getting $32 million for every airplane that he brought online, which gave him about an $8 million profit. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still there and out, you know, running out of words here. It seems they were really also involved in the whole company.
Yeah. The anyway, so I ended up working for them, you know, for 9 years. Yeah. And, of course, I flew the Gulfstream 4s, and then when they got out with the 5 Series, they typed me in the 5 Series. And the type rating on that type of aircraft, just to pay for the type rating, was $50,000. Somebody had to pay for the type rating. And, of course, Buffett owned Flight Safety, and he owned NetJets. As I say, it was Executive Jet, but they changed the name later to NetJets because the news, a corporate jet would crash, and then somebody would say, the news media would say, an Executive Jet crashed today, and they realized, wait a minute, that wasn't one of our jets. Let's change the name. We're getting bad publicity, so they changed their name to NetJets.
Yeah.
And anyway, I flew for them for about 9.5 years, and I flew people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tiger Woods, Julia Roberts, and flew all over the world because the Gulfstream could go, the 550 could go from Beijing to New York nonstop in 13 and a half hours, and it had 15 hours of fuel on it. And I did that. And in the book that Chris wrote, he's got a lot of the stories of what I told, but that was the best job I ever had. And the only reason I retired from that was in 2008, when we had an economic downturn in the States. A lot of the people that were in that program got out of the program, and so they needed to lay off pilots, but they didn't want to furlough, so they came to the pilots and they said, if you've been here 3.5 years and you'd like to retire, we'll give you 70% of your pay for 3 years and all your company benefits, just as if you were a full-time employee. Well, for me, 70% of my pay was $93,000 a year for 3 years, plus all my insurance, which they paid 100% of it, and all the other benefits. And I was 65 at the time. And I thought, yeah, I'll go see my doctor, Dr. Young, and get a first-class medical, because you had to have one every 6 months. And at 65, I thought, and so that gave me, with the benefits and everything, over $300,000 to retire. Plus, while you're working there, the 401 retirement program, they matched you 50 cents on the dollar for the full 15%, and I had over $300,000 in that program in just 9 years. So basically, they're saying, if you'll go ahead and retire, we'll give you $500,000. And when you're 65, that sounded like a good idea. So I retired.
retired. I mean, quote unquote. You're still flying, yeah. John. You're still flying.
Yeah, well, people tell me, they say, when are you going to retire? And I says, I've already retired. And they say, well, wait a minute, you're still flying. I says, well, like with the job I'm doing now, I tell people my biggest decision is, what am I going to do for lunch? And then if I have to do something, I have to fly an airplane.
Yeah.
So I've started out with the Sheriff's Department. I volunteered to fly for them for free because I had the time when I was working for NetJets, because I worked 7 days on and had 7 days off. And, So on my 7 days off, I said, I'll fly for you part-time. But then the chief deputy, when we approached him on that, he said, yeah, we'd love to have you part-time, but you can't do it for free. We've got to pay you. So I said, well, okay, pay me. And so that's how I ended up with the sheriff's department. And I ended up, well, I've been there almost 15 years now, part-time and full-time. And but I'm the type of person that if I'm not working, I'm lazy. And I find on the weekends, if I don't have something to do, I normally go to the airport, but if the weather's bad, I sit at home and watch television, and that's not a very productive thing to do. So they only pay me for like 3 days a week, but I go in 5 days a week, and right now they're down to me and one other pilot that are part-time because all of our full-time pilots at the Sheriff's Department have left and gone to work for the airlines. So I'm still working full-time, getting part-time pay, but what I'm getting paid at my age and getting paid to fly, I think it's a really good deal.
Yeah, and a really good life, I think. I mean, you're definitely an icon of aviation, and yeah, allow me, with over 30,000 hours behind you in the air, certainly, what's your take on the question, what separates a competent pilot from a great one in general, John?
Well, the big thing is staying current. In other words, you've got to, you can't just fly once every now and then, you know, and do that. And the problem is with the cost of aviation today for a general aviation pilot to stay current, they've got to have a lot of money, maybe even own their airplane, something like that. But the airlines, I found that the best pilots, because I was involved in a lot of training, the best pilots that I saw weren't necessarily the military pilots, because they're doing a different type of flying than they do with the airlines. The best pilots were the ones that came up through the commuters, where they had to hand fly the airplane. They didn't have autopilots, and they're going in and out of different airports, you know, every day. And because I'd get them in the simulator, for example, and the people that really knew the automation, man, they were great with the automation. But if you started shutting down the automation and they had to hand fly the aircraft, the pilots that came up where they had to hand fly the aircraft were the more competent pilots. And I think the FAA is starting to see that now. They're starting to say they and I've said this all along, they need to get back to stick and rudder skills. So when all that automation starts failing, that they can know how to fly the airplane. I remember when I was teaching on the MD-80s, it was the first glass cockpit, highly automated airplane that I flew. And as this automation started failing, you'd have to get back to making it a DC-9, because what it was actually a DC-9-80. So it had all the basic stuff, but then it had the glass cockpit, all the computers and stuff like that. And so I'd tell the people, the students, and I'd say, there's one button in here, this airplane, that turns it from an MD-80 into a DC-9. And they'd say, what's that? And I'd say, autopilot disconnect. Just turn off the autopilot and fly the airplane. And so that's what the people really need to get back to do, is just, you need to know the computers. You need to know how to make it, and the airlines want you to use that, because the airplane, with all that modern stuff, can actually do a better job than the pilots can, as far as saving money, performance, and stuff like that. But you really need to keep up your basic skills of how to fly the airplane. And so that's the big difference. The people that go out and work, keep their skills up. I'd see people that I flew for with the airlines, they were ex-military people. When they finished their trip, they went home and they didn't even think about airplanes. then there would be people like myself that we owned our own airplanes and we flew for the airlines. And when we weren't flying for the airlines, we were out flying our Cubs and Champs and Cessnas and stuff like that. And working with several different airlines, the people that stayed involved in aviation other than just flying for a living were the better pilots.
So stick and rudder skills and versatile aviation experience are still the foundation of, so to say, of an excellent pilot of a great pilot.
Yeah, and just for example, you take I've owned like four Ronca Champs, and I've got one right now. And these airplanes with a 65 horsepower engine, if you get in trouble, you can't use the power to get you out of trouble. You have to fly the wing. You don't fly the engine and use all that stuff. You have to know what the wing's doing and how it's doing it. And you can't. People say, well, you can get behind a jet because it's moving so fast. Well, you can get behind a light airplane because it's moving too slow. And then once you get behind the power curve on a light airplane, unless you have some altitude where you can change that altitude into energy, you're in deep trouble. And I'm also a glider pilot and a glider CFI, and that really, really helps. One of my instructors, when I was getting my glider rating, he says, well, you just don't want to get low and slow in a glider. He says, in an airplane, if you get low and slow, you add power. In a glider, if you get low and slow, you crash. That's the difference.
Altitude is safety. This is what my glider flight instructor put in my brain. And it's, yeah, it's altitude and speed is safety.
Yeah.
But John, we are getting towards the end of this interview. If a young pilot is listening today and could take one piece of advice from you, besides the stick and rudder skill or what you just shared with us, what would it be? You know, if somebody is listening now, dreaming of a career in aviation, maybe in high school age, what would you tell him or her?
The best way to have a really good career in aviation, if you can pass the physical, is to go in the military, because they are going to pay you to learn how to fly. The training they give you is the best in the world. And I said, you know, I found the guys that came up through the ranks were better, but the military now is actually getting more and more into the stick and rudder stuff as well as the computer stuff. As I'd say, if you can get into a reserve officer's program, the ROTC, get into a flight program, spend your time in the military. The military is a good career. I spent time in the Marines. They say a Marine, once a Marine, always a Marine. A Marine just comes off of active duty. He doesn't ever leave the Corps. But the military is a good way to do it. If you aren't enlightened to go into the military, then nowadays they've got it so black that you don't have to have college degrees anymore and things like that. But that's just a trend of the times. Having a college degree doesn't make you a better pilot. It just shows them that you're capable of learning something. That's why they like to see it.
Yeah.
So, but the big thing is if you can do it, unless you just don't want to go in the military, if you can do it, is probably the best way to have a real good career. But stay involved in the little airplanes as well as the big airplanes. I've got a real good friend now. He's a retired Brigadier General. He flew F-16s in Iraq and Iran and the wars over there. And I see him every day, and he has an RV-8, and he's still flying little airplanes, and he's a retired Brigadier General. So he stayed involved in aviation, you know, outside of the military. He's an excellent pilot. So the biggest thing is you go somewhere and somebody will say, I always wanted to be a pilot. And I say, no, you don't. You like the idea of being a pilot. But if you really wanted to do it, you would have done it. But most people don't realize how hard it is just to get a private pilot's license. When you get that license, you know 70 to 80% of everything that the airline pilot knows, because you had to know the regulations, you have to know weather, you have to do that. And so the big thing is people say, well, I can't afford it. Well, I started out with a paper route, making a nickel of paper. So I made $2 a week. My dad said, you want to eat your lunch at school or take your lunch? And I said, I'll eat my lunch at school. So he gave me 25 cents a day to buy my lunch. So that was another $1.25. I'd sneak into the kitchen at night, make a sandwich so I could have my lunch. I'd save that money. And it was $8 an hour dual to take lessons in a Ronca Champ. So about once a month, I'd save up enough money where I could ride my bicycle to the airport when I was 12, 14, 15 years old to take lessons. And my dad would not sign to let me fly. You had to have your parents' signature, but he let me join the Marine Corps Reserves. And there was a regulation that says if you're a member of an active armed forces reserve, you don't have to have your parents' consent. So I soloed, and because I didn't have this consent, because he let me join the reserves my senior year of high school, I flew over the house and I came home and he says, was that you flying over the house today? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, how did you do that? I didn't sign for you to do that. And so I explained, well, you let me join the Marines and that gave me a way to do it. And he says, well, I don't have to worry about you anymore. Just don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do something. Now, sometimes there's physical problems that you can't do it. Obviously, if you're blind and can't see, you can't fly an airplane. But don't let them tell you that you can't do that. I was told that when I first started, I could not get a major medical because I got hit in the eye with a baseball as a kid and I had a cataract. But then I found that there's a way of getting around that. You can get demonstrated ability and stuff like that. So I just never had somebody tell me that I couldn't do something. And my dad said, well, I don't have to worry about you. Just don't let people tell you that. You figure out how to go around it, over it, under it, or through it, and just go on. You know, I always said my definition of life is dreams and memories. And the way that means is you have a dream of something you want to do. And if you can turn that dream into a memory, you have been successful. And so the more of your dreams that you can turn into your memories, that determines your success in life.
John, I was dreaming last night from a great interview. The dream came true. And I don't know, so many questions are left. I think we have to somehow come up with a second part sooner or later, or maybe a third part. It's just your wealth of wisdom, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for every minute, sir. And one more time, yeah, it's just incredible. Thank you for your time, and I hope you fly, you know, until you are 100 plus. Let's leave it like this.
Well, I'll fly as long as that's God's plan. And the thing is, as I say, I've been a very religious person, I guess you'd call it, but God has a plan for everybody. And if you just, you know, listen to his plan and follow it, your life will be success, whether you're a pilot or whatever you do. Because one thing my dad told me, he says, and I talk too much. That's why Chris told me, he says, talk to this guy. You like to talk. He wants to do an interview. So my dad told me, he says, you can only learn something when you're listening, because when you're talking, you say something you already know. And if God wanted us to have, if he wanted us to talk more than listen, he would have given us two mouths rather than two ears.
Thank you, John. Thank you for the interview. And as I said, I hope we can make a part two, three. So I think your stories, they would last for, 10, 20 podcasts. Great.
Okay, and that brings us to the end of the interview. How was that for you, Jürgen, listening to it again?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, as you said, I mean, Stefan, imagine John Pipkin running his own podcast with solo episodes, yeah. Publishing one every week. I think he could go on for decades.
Yes.
Yes. You know, if you make, I mean, every... It's especially in the last minute, but all over the place. I mean, if you make deep dives into everything he just covered, this would be a podcast on its own, a John Pipkin podcast, only solo episodes, no guests, and or somebody interviewing him maybe, but this would be a John Pipkin podcast for decades.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing guy. And at this point, I would really like to say thank you to Krzysztof Paryszewski, who sort of introduced us to John and recommended that we... So he sort of established the contact between us and John. And I'm really glad he did so, because I think it was a really nice interview. Just one personal note from my point of view. Towards the end, John was talking about dreams and memories, and I actually thought that was a really great way of looking at life and how you walk through life. I thought that was a very beautiful way of putting his life philosophy. That to me was a really, really great part of the interview.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to say to Krzysztof Paryszewski, you already recognized it with the voicemails we exchanged, Stefan. He became a little bit like a mentor behind our podcast. So many guest connection, and I remember Krzysztof wrote me something along the lines of, I got a guest for you, but it's impossible to cover his life in a podcast. Yeah, he proved to be right. Krzysztof Paryszewski himself was a guest in episode 14. He is certainly our seaplane enthusiast and instructor. And he captured John Pipkin's more than remarkable life in his German book, Traumberuf Pilot, Das unglaubliche Fliegerleben des John Pipkin. And more about the book you find on Christoph's homepages. It's either bushpilot.at or aviator.at. So on both homepages, if you control F and then Pipkin, you will get to the book. And otherwise, write me. I will lead you to Christoph's books. And book maybe also... It may be also published in English in the future, but I think we will keep you up to date here on the podcast anyway, because as it looks by now, Krzysztof is our mentor and I will get first-hand information about the book and what's going on, because I think after this podcast, many listeners will want to read it or would want to read it in English, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, like we said in the intro, you know, this guy, you know, when people say this guy has done it all, it's like a phrase that's used quite often. I think when it comes to John, this guy has really done it all. So it's a remarkable man, remarkable career. And I was really glad we got him on the podcast, that he took some time out of his busy schedule. And I'm also very happy to hear that he's still very much involved in aviation, because it seems to be his lifelong love and passion. So glad to see he's still in the skies.
Yeah, and certainly I wish him all the best and maybe a couple of more appearances at Aviation Quest this year. This, speaking of dreams, this would be a dream of us coming true.
Yes, absolutely. If there were certain aspects where he just glossed over, where I thought, "Ooh, I would really like to hear more about them."
Dozens of aspects, I'd say.
Yes, really interesting parts of his life that I would have loved to hear more. But you know, we only have so much time, and we don't want to occupy our guests for hours. So we are always grateful when people take time to talk to us. And so also on my behalf, even though I wasn't at the interview, a big, big thank you to John for taking his time, for giving us his time to talk to us. So that was great. And once again, Jürgen, amazing interview. Thank you so much for organizing it and for doing it. And yeah, I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as I did. And yeah, I guess we will say goodbye now. So from my side, thank you very much for listening. And we look forward to hearing you in the next podcast. Jürgen, you want to say anything else?
A little side note from my side, Stefan, if you allow.
Of course.
Because it's a Thursday, it's 2 p.m. This means in an hour from now, the next mental coaching article of mine will be online, or column of mine at LinkedIn. It's on my LinkedIn profile every Thursday afternoon, normally, so around 3 p.m., because I also have sometimes schedules. Give me 30 minutes plus or minus, around 3 p.m., a new article is online. Yeah, and I mean, speaking of mental strengths, certainly it takes much more to be mentally strong, to become a John Pipkin. But if you are struggling with the nerves in the cockpit or in interviews or before a sim check, I'd be happy to help. As Stefan knows, I'm working really hard in this realm of mental coaching in the moment. And I am, yeah, I think I'm approachable. Just check out the coaching button on our homepage, and I'm approachable for free, non-obligational initial consultation, complicated wording here, to explore your needs and how I can help you. And yeah, also on LinkedIn, I think take a look at my LinkedIn page, and yeah, I'd be happy to read from you. But other than that, I'd say stay on Aviation Quest CC, maybe subscribe to it. Also the YouTube channel, please subscribe. And in one go, certainly also to Stefan's YouTube channel, FS Clips, because already in the next episode, it's so to say a birthday episode, 30 podcasts of Aviation Quest CC. Yeah, we made it. We have a really, really special guest, huh? We just, no spoiler alert, but there is something really special coming up. So we have special after special in the moment. This was super special from John. Thank you, John, from all of my heart. It was a pleasure. Hope to have you back, but also podcast 30 is more than worth listening.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, Jürgen, for those of you who are new to the channel, maybe this is the first time you were listening to us, in terms of Jürgen's credential, in terms of coaching, if you either listen to episode 1 where we introduce ourselves, or if you just look up Jürgen's career, you will not come across any other person who has more experience with mental coaching than Jürgen, because of his absolutely outstanding background and career. So I would highly recommend you look at that and take him up on his offer.
I'm glad that we don't have a video podcast. I am, let's keep it grounded. Check out my LinkedIn page or Google for me and make your own opinion. And this was Stefan's opinion, and I am more than flattered. Thank you, Stefan.
No problem, Jürgen. Well, I really look forward to talking to you again soon. Next time we will introduce our next guest, episode 30. Really special, like you said. And I really look forward to talking to you again, Jürgen. I wish you all the best. And talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Aviation Quest CC, Stories from Above. For more information about this episode and everything we do, visit our homepage, aviation-quest.cc. We appreciate your time and support, and we'd love to have you back for the next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay curious, and keep your passion for aviation flying high.